Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We started with a three-page bailout plan from Henry Paulson. Senate Democrats offered 44 pages of their own. Now House Republicans have upped the ante to 102. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, helping America go green. You can calculate your carbon savings at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 26th of September. It's Friday, and it is great to have you here as we continue with Fallout, our coverage of America's financial crisis. About the only thing that stayed consistent with this story this week is how quickly it has been changing. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about the current state of negotiations, about a little bank failure that happened last night that you might have heard of, and a look back at the week that was. We're going to begin, though, with what you might call a buying opportunity for congressional lawmakers. Because whenever a big package makes its way through the legislative process, it inevitably gets bigger. Items get added, new proposals are proposed, and while the stakes may be higher this time, it's really not so different. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
If the definition of a compromise is that no one walks away completely happy, maybe there's hope Washington can still find some kind of common ground. But it clearly isn't easy. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid complained today Republican mavericks need to get real.
Are they serious about one of the issues that has to be taken care of is lowering the capital gains tax? Is that part of what this is all about?
Here's an issue that is being taken seriously, the need to help Main Street as much as Wall Street by helping strapped homeowners make their payments. John Taylor heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, an advocacy group for subprime borrowers.
We saw 300,000 foreclosures last month. That's what we used to get in a year. If you don't get ahead of that problem, you're going to continue to have to go back to Wall Street to bail them out.
The big sticking point has to be, well, what about the little guy? Doesn't he or she have to bear a little bit of responsibility here?
Edward Fredericks is a finance professor at California's Pepperdine University. He says sorting out which homeowners really deserve help is tricky.
Not everybody was truthful on their mortgage application. There are a lot of people out there that tried to rig the system themselves.
Fredericks also says the idea of simply insuring toxic mortgage-backed securities is much more complicated than buying them outright, as the Bush administration wants. Until those securities are sold, he says, it's impossible to know how much to insure them for. Some in Congress and elsewhere are pushing for the federal government to get equity stakes in the companies taking part in the rescue, essentially charging for seats on the lifeboat. But critics argue that could further sap the strength of banks already in danger of sinking. Professor Frederick says there's a danger of trying to do too much. Congress could blunt the psychological impact of sure and swift action.
What could happen is then we might slowly kind of just wallow here as we wait for this very dim light at the end of the tunnel to get much brighter.
And Senate Leader Harry Reid suggests Wall Street needs action, not perfection.
No matter what we do here, we'll be imperfect, but we have to do something for the American people.
In other words, choose your poison. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The deal that pretty much everybody thought we had at the end of the business day yesterday came undone late last night, Washington time. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is here to do that thing he does so well, explain what happened and where things stand right now. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
All right, latest and greatest, please.
Well, it's been a pretty confusing day. A lot of off-again, on-again meetings around the Capitol. The leaders, the congressional leaders, Treasury Secretary Paulson was there, staff members. Legislating is always an unwieldy thing, and trying to do something this big, this costly, this fast, with such deadline pressure and this close to an election day, it's really something to watch. And after really being close to an agreement yesterday, it seemed like a final compromise just got further away today. Although most of those in the know figure that some sort of government initiative will pass sometime in the next few days.
Have to ask you, though, John, where the Republicans have been on this. It's not like it's a new story, and the deal has come undone now in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, they did come in late, but they haven't been united. You know, it took them a while for their ideas to gel. There are several different notions that the fiscal conservatives are raising, but not one plan. They're basing their objections more on principle. They feel the government's response should be more free enterprise, less heavy-handed government. Plus, they're hearing plenty of the very loud objections from many Americans to Secretary Paulson's plan, and they complain that alternatives haven't been considered in this charged financial atmosphere. Today, John Boehner, the top House Republican, told reporters that yesterday his caucus was feeling a bit left out.
I don't know what games were being played at the White House yesterday, ganging up on Boehner, but they thought they were rolling me. They were kidding themselves.
The Democrats obviously are in the majority up there, John, on the Hill. What are they saying?
Well, they're letting the White House deal with all these renegade members of their own party. They have the luxury of looking like a unified party for once. They've been carrying the White House's plan through this process. Late today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi seemed optimistic that something's going to get done.
I believe that a great progress is being made. As I have said before, we will not leave until a legislation is passed that will be signed by the president, and we will be working through the weekend to achieve that end.
On the other hand, the Democrats are also hearing the public's protests, and they know that they're taking a risk by endorsing this rescue plan. So that's why they want some cover from Republicans. They don't want this to be seen as a Democrats' big government solution to a Wall Street crisis, especially if down the road it turns out to be the wrong move.
Mm. The lead Republican these days, John McCain, has announced he is going to go to the debate. I guess we're going to hear some economic questions tonight, aren't we?
Absolutely. That was another cliffhanger all day today, whether John McCain would even participate if there wasn't a deal, which he said he wouldn't do. But about midday, his campaign announced that he'll fly down to Mississippi to debate. So we'll have to see.
Are lawmakers glad to see him go, do you think?
Absolutely. They were blaming the presence of the candidates for derailing yesterday's negotiations. And they're saying both of them should just leave town and let them get back to the hard bargaining without the presidential posturing getting in the way.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Here we are a week and a day into negotiations over a bailout plan, and today at least, the markets almost couldn't be bothered. The major indices held steady most of the day. The Dow actually gained 1%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm going to swing by the bank when I get out of here this afternoon. I'm going to slide my card in the ATM, and I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that money comes out. Because my bank got a visit from federal regulators late last night. They took control of Washington Mutual, promptly sold its biggest parts to J.P. Morgan. Yes, deposits are insured, and yes, J.P. Morgan does seem to be reasonably sound, but it is the biggest bank failure in the history of this country. So we went to Portland, Oregon, to see how the news and the whole week are going over.
I don't have enough funds in Washington Mutual to truly worry about it, but yeah, it's not, from a stability standpoint, it's not a good thing.
I was going to get a little cash, but instead I took out my maximum for today. I don't know, just in case.
I have my money here because this is not a huge amount, but we have $15,000 on the accounts, which pretty soon we're going to spend it because we're going to open another business really soon.
I was a little surprised this morning, opened the papers, like, oh, look at that. My bank was seized.
We just heard from Brian Robinson, Carla Zerbes, Uriel Olvera, and Michael Sexton up in Portland, Oregon, talking to our Mitchell Hartman there. J.P. Morgan, you might remember, is the same company that gobbled up Bear Stearns back in March when the financial markets really started coming unhinged. And last night's developments make it an even bigger fish in a rapidly shrinking pond. Too big to fail? Ring a bell here, anybody? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Charlie Scharf heads up J.P. Morgan Chase's retail business. He says J.P. Morgan's size is an asset.
It's the convenience, it's the branding, it's the ubiquity you have, and it just makes our jobs a whole lot easier, but probably more importantly, it's much easier for the customers to do business with us.
Easier, but probably more expensive. That's what Don Vickrey thinks. He's co-founder of Gradient Analytics.
As we exit this whole restructuring process with far fewer banks, the consumer may not get quite the competitive rates for services that they would have gotten previously.
But Vickrey says consumers might be willing to pay more for convenience, and they may find it easier to get a loan. Carrie Leahy of Decision Economics says big banks can help loosen the credit crunch.
Right now, we're happy with larger institutions that are effectively run and will be more likely to make loans than otherwise, and let's worry about size a little bit later.
But William Black says size matters now. Black teaches economics at the University of Missouri. He says huge banks like J.P. Morgan that both lend and invest are dangerous. That's because they could end up lending money to a company they invested in to prop it up.
They are going to be so huge in the future that they'll have a combination of political power, economic power, and they'll simply be too expensive to allow to fail.
Black says, guess who will be called upon to save them? Yep, you, the taxpayer. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Do us a favor and tell us how the financial crisis is affecting you. That'll help us tell the story. Go to Marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. Boy, it's been a heck of a week, hasn't it? The deal was on, then it was off. The economy was collapsing, but not yet, it seems. We're going to take a couple of minutes here and try to digest all that's happened. Katie Benner is with Fortune Magazine. David Leonhardt is at the New York Times. Hello to you both.
Hi.
It's good to be here.
David, let me ask you first, when you got news of this deal dying last night, what was your first thought?
My first thought was definitely surprise. I mean, it really seemed like the Democratic leadership in Congress and the White House had come to a deal on this. But the Democrats have made clear all along, they're not going to do this unless the Republicans go along with it too.
Katie, what about you?
My first thought was this is very, very partisan. The Republicans are definitely trying to tap into a real rage that's growing all throughout America. We're very close to an election, so I wasn't exactly surprised.
David, do you get a sense of anger out there when you do your reporting?
I definitely do, and I was talking to a friend of mine who does more reporting out in the country as opposed to in Washington and New York, and he said that he thinks there's a good chance that people in Washington and to some extent New York are underestimating the level of the anger there. And I think to some extent that is a criticism of Bernanke and Paulson, because I think they've done a good job of explaining the stakes here to members of Congress. I don't think they've done a good job at all of explaining to the public what they're afraid of. And so in the end, this really does feel like a Wall Street bailout to a lot of people, which it is to some extent, but it does not feel like something that the Fed and the Treasury feel that is necessary in order to stem a credit crisis that very much will affect Main Street.
Katie, what stands out to you about the way this whole thing has evolved from a week ago yesterday when Bernanke and Paulson had that first meeting up on Capitol Hill?
The crushing speed with which things have unfolded, and it sort of feels like that moment after Enron where people were piling in to try to create legislation or to create rules to stem a problem because people were angry. This is that times 1,000, and we're not even sure what they're doing. Nobody really understands the plan.
Well, David, let me ask you about that. How did it come to pass that the Paulson-Bernanke plan is the only plan? You talked about this in the paper on Wednesday.
Well, I think to some extent the Fed and the Treasury have been wargaming this for a while. I think it's unlikely that they threw this together in just a day. But after the credit markets froze up last week, they made it clear that they thought this was urgent. I think Congress has done the right thing by making some changes to the bill. I don't love every change that Congress has made, but on the whole, I think the more important ones are good ones. But I think the risks here are significant, and I think there's a good argument that whether we need it this week or not, we don't have a few months to try to hold commissions and hearings to try to figure out exactly what the plan is that we should come up with.
Katie, what about your thoughts? Do you think this is the best plan, or should we be paying attention to other smart economists out there? Richard Shelby, the Senate Banking Committee ranking Republican, said he has this list of 200 people who disagree with the bailout.
I think there is a valid criticism that in throwing money at the situation, we're not addressing the root of the problem. The root of the problem being the fact that there are mortgages that were made that were bad, that were then used to create all sorts of other products. The question is, by taking these out of the hands of the banks, will this really make banks lend again? That's the question. How do we make sure that banks then do what we want them to do once we've helped them?
David, how do we do that?
Well, one of the hardest things about trying to go to the root of the problem is that it's very difficult to bail out homeowners who are about to foreclose on their mortgages without also ending up bailing out a lot of people who otherwise would not. If I hear the government's helping people who are walking away from their homes or who are going to be foreclosed on, you can be darn sure that I'm going to step forward and say, hey, that's me too. But There's no really obvious solution here, and I'm actually quite sympathetic to the argument that Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, made this week that basically says, look, there is no magic bullet here. We got to try a whole bunch of different things to try to solve this.
Let me ask you both this question quickly as we wrap things up. Katie, do you have any doubt that we're going to be back on this issue and some kind of bailout in January?
I have no doubt that we'll be talking about this again.
David?
I think we know that the way people feel about the economy tends to lag what the numbers on the economy show, and that suggests there's just almost no question that the economy will be the dominant issue for 2009.
David Leonhardt at the New York Times, Katie Benner at Fortune Magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, when a picture is worth more than a thousand words.
A lot of the money giving that was done was photo ops. And, you know, you put the photo up and, you know, you said I was with so-and-so in the Association of Power.
But first, let's do the numbers. So, deal or no deal? The Dow Industrials gained 1.1%. Today, 121 points, finished at 11,143. The NASDAQ lost just 0.1%, 3 points, finished at 2,183. The S&P 500 tacked on 0.3%, 4 points, closed at 1,213. The cliffhanger week left the Dow down 2%. The NASDAQ shaved off 4%. The S&P 500 gave back 3.25%. There was blood on the floor for bank stocks after Washington Mutual staggered into the arms of J.P. Morgan Chase, as we mentioned. National City lost more than 25%. Wachovia plummeted 27%. Shares in Downey Financial lost nearly half of their value. On the winning end, the ever-expanding J.P. Morgan picked up 11%. Another behemoth, Bank of America, bulked up 6.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. And by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence. Online at SaveAndInvest.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department releases the August report on personal income. Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaks with students about the 2008 National Defense Strategy. And on this day in 1936, radio was used for the first time in a presidential campaign. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, the good news is that Hurricane Kyle doesn't look like it's going to be that big a deal. The National Weather Service says the storm is going to miss the United States. The bad news is that oil and gas production haven't really recovered from Ike and Gustav yet. About 60% of crude production in the Gulf of Mexico is still offline, and refineries are just now getting back online. That's almost 2 weeks after the storms. That disruption has led to serious gas shortages in some parts of the southeast, as Julie Rose reports from WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina.
For the last 3 days, gas pumps in Charlotte have seemed to fuel more panic than cars. Most pumps are completely empty, and long lines are causing traffic jams at the few stations that do have gas. Anxious drivers have even taken to following fuel trucks off the freeway with portable gas cans in hand.
Can I get 10 on 3 out of that guy?
Station manager Jackson Tanous got only half his normal gas shipment on Wednesday. He's trying to make it last by limiting purchases to $25.
They want more, but we want to give everybody gas.
Barbara Smith drove from one empty pump to another for nearly an hour before arriving here on fumes.
I thought they was going to have to push me up to the pump.
Cities in Alabama, Georgia, and Tennessee have felt a similar pinch. They all rely on the same pipeline that comes from the Gulf Coast. A large shipment of gas is expected in Charlotte by the weekend. But Carol Gifford of AAA says,
it will take about 7 to 10 days still until we see more normal flow of gasoline through the pipeline.
Until then, local officials are pleading with motorists to drive less and fill up only when absolutely necessary, if they can even find gas to pump. In Charlotte, I'm Julie Rose for Marketplace.
Presidential politics hit Wall Street head-on this week. Nothing like two candidates and the actual president to throw a wrench in congressional negotiations, as John Dimsdale was telling us up at the top of the broadcast. But whichever party wins the credit crisis solution war, both of them are going to keep collecting contributions from big businesses, Wall Street and otherwise. You always hear politicians say there's no quid pro quo for the donations they get. But commentator and economist Edward Miguel has some new data about how politics does pay off on Wall Street.
Critics of our campaign finance system fear growing corruption. Are contributions too often the quid pro quo for favorable government regulation or no-bid contracts? New economics research using stock prices finds that political ties can be quite profitable for U.S. firms. The idea is simple. Compare companies that cultivate ties with Democrats through campaign contributions or board memberships or lobbying to the firms that give to or hire Republicans. Once election results are in, the stock price movements of these two groups of firms reveal the market value of their political allegiances. The research shows that the stock market value of companies with former Republican lawmakers on their boards increased an average of 4%, not a small amount, when the Supreme Court handed the 2000 presidential election to George W. Bush. The impact of political connections was even greater for companies involved in government contracting. At the same time, companies with Democrats on their boards saw share prices decline. The same pattern occurred, only in reverse, when Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party in 2001, handing Senate control to the Democrats. The United States is not alone in favoring the politically connected. An earlier study found that companies with close ties to Indonesia's former president Suharto gained 25% in value on the Jakarta exchange. But the fact that the U.S. is better than Indonesia, a country notorious for its crony capitalism, will do little to reassure Americans concerned about corruption. Whether it's in the U.S. or in developing countries, there's apparently a very good reason for corporations to cultivate political ties, their bottom line. With the polls still tight in the presidential race, there are bound to be some surprises by Election Day. To figure out what connections to the presidential candidates are worth, keep an eye on the stock market in the days after November 4th.
Edward Miguel is a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called Economic Gangsters: Corruption, Violence, and the Poverty of Nations. Do us a favor and send us your thoughts. Our website works best, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. Even though the financial markets are still a mess, a president's work is never done. President Bush hosted India's prime minister at the White House last night. I'd guess they probably chatted a bit, anyway, about the state of economic affairs. But the main topic of discussion between the two countries is whether Congress is going to let the United States share civilian nuclear technology. The potential deal says a lot about India's rise on the world stage and about the growing influence of Indian Americans. Ashwini Anbarajan has more.
Shekhar Narasimhan has a long history of writing checks and saying, cheese. At the office of his consulting firm in Northern Virginia, he points to a framed photo of himself, his wife, and First Lady Hillary Clinton.
That picture is taken in the stateroom of the White House, and she's wearing a salwar kameez.
To get that picture with Mrs. Clinton in her bright red Indian dress, the Narasimhans gave thousands of dollars to Democratic candidates.
A lot of the money giving that was done was photo ops. And, you know, you put the photo up and, you know, you said, I was with so-and-so in the Association of Power.
2 years ago, Narasimhan's fundraising muscle helped Democrat Jim Webb win Virginia's Senate seat. During the presidential primaries, Indian American donors gave $5 million each to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and $500,000 to John McCain. They've had some legislative successes. nudging Congress to fast-track the Indian Civil Nuclear Treaty, and getting state governments to amend hate crime laws to include South Asians.
What's important is a seat at the table.
Neil Dillon is a longtime political lobbyist.
As strong as we are, several million strong, we've never had a cabinet-level appointment. We've never had even a deputy secretary cabinet-level appointment.
And that's the real issue, says Narasimhan.
So we need leadership, and we need to influence that leadership that wants to stand up for us.
In other words, more Indian Americans in public office, like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. So Narasimhan and other donors have poured resources into a PAC, the Indian American Leadership Initiative.
All the digits, I hope they all come together.
The group had its coming out party last month in Denver.
We have one political mission, and that is to elect Ashwin Mehdia to the United States Congress.
Candidates like Ashwin Mehdia, who's running for Congress in Minnesota, are reaping the benefits. The PAC connects Indian American candidates to their community's donor base, provides volunteers for their campaigns, and advises on strategy. They've only operated at the state and local level so far, but now plan to have a national presence. Neil Dillon says 2008 is about shattering political barriers.
The sky's the limit. Glass ceilings are being broken. And Indian Americans need to, help be part of that glass ceiling being broken.
The weight of all that cash could be enough to let them burst through. In Washington, D.C., I'm Ashwini Anbarajan for Marketplace.
That report was produced for us in collaboration with the New School in New York City.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final thoughts to bring an end to a crazy, crazy week. Gold jumped 4% today. Not an uncommon move in uncertain economic times, but it does put a strain on the U.S. Mint. The Mint announced today it's suspending sales of its American Buffalo 24-karat gold coins because it can't keep up with demand. It's completely sold out, in fact. That's a circumstance not unfamiliar to gas station owners in the Southeast, as we told you earlier. But now it's getting really grim. In Atlanta today, a petroleum company CEO said there might not be enough gas for everybody who wants to be able to drive to the University of Georgia football game this weekend up in Athens. And he said that the game against Alabama ought to be canceled. This is the SEC we're talking about, the Southeastern Conference. And they really don't kid around about their football. So I'd say that game's going to happen just as scheduled. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 121 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ fell 3 points. That's a 10%. The S&P 500 added 4 points. That's a third of 1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Tune in this weekend. We'll have more coverage of what's happening in Washington and how it affects your wallet. That's on our personal finance program, Marketplace Money. And in case you missed anything this week, you can catch up with our coverage of the financial crisis. We've got a new podcast. Just head to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on that link that says, yeah, podcast. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.